We live in very interesting times, very pivotal times, times when things are changing in ways they've never changed before, and things are happening all around the world in ways that they've never happened before. We live in an age when those things which were always taken for granted are not taken for granted anymore. We understand that the sun, the moon, the rains, the earth, all of these things are not eternal. We understand these things are to some degree under our control. We live in an age when the air that we breathe has been changed by humanity, where nature has, in a sense, ceased to exist, or in some cases has turned into something hostile, so that we're afraid to step out into the sun because we think the sun is bad for us, when we have to wear protective masks. And one of the reasons my voice is rough this evening, because I'm still suffering from the flu I picked up in India. And just from breathing the air, we've turned the air into something toxic. And so we live in this age where all these things are coming together in a way that's just completely unpredictable. And as well known, it was a certain rather depressive character by the name of Malthus, who first did the sort of calculations on population growth and use of resources, and making the obvious assumption that human population, or observation that human population tends to grow, but the resources that we use remain the same. And so there's inevitably going to come some collision point where these things will collapse. And I don't know if the details of things have worked out the way that Malthus predicted, but certainly we feel more and more the pinch of the impact of these kinds of things. We feel the impact of living in a world where water is a scarce resource, and where nations are coming to blows over water, reminding us of the story, of course, in the Buddha's time, when the two nations come to blows over the irrigation water from a certain river. And the Buddha intervened and said, which is more valuable, water or blood? Of course, the answer is blood is much more valuable, so why would you spill blood for the sake of water? And of course, this is happening more and more pressingly today. The water is running out. Many countries, including Australia, have severe problems with the water. The trees are running out. You know, we get a bit complacent here at Santi. We live in one of the very few places surrounded by thousands and thousands of trees. We look out of the view here, and 100 kilometers it goes, and there's just trees as far as you can look. No humans. And this is such a rare thing in the world. If you go almost anywhere, you drive around Australia, everywhere you drive, you see fields, you see paddocks, you see open places. Remember that all of those open places you see, almost all of them were covered with trees, unless you go out in the desert, of course, when it was just scrub and so on. But in these lands to the east and the south and so on, all of this was covered with forest when the white people first arrived in Australia. And the same when it was in India, and I was just there, and you drive around and you look around you, and you know that in the time of the Buddha, much of what you were seeing was massive rainforests filled with all kinds of exotic animals, and filled with unimaginable genetic diversity. All of that's gone, and there's just bare, dusty fields. That's all that's left. And for a long time, people have been worried about these things. Even reading in Dostoevsky, I remember noticing that he was writing in the last part of the 19th century, and some of his characters were voicing their tremendous concern over the loss of the Russian forests, what this would mean, that all the forests were being cut down at such a tremendous rate. And so these resources are being used up more and more and more. The extent of the depletion of fish is almost incomprehensible, almost inconceivable. There's almost like 80 or 90% of all of the large-sized fish that are edible, or around the size that can be edible and so on, are gone in all of the oceans in most parts of the world. They're just not there anymore. And we can go on and on and on talking about global warming and all of these kinds of things. And so these things are creating a world that we don't know what's going to happen. And when people look at these things, there are basically two kinds of responses to them. One is the kind of the depressive or the negative response, which is like Malthus, which is to say, well, resources are running out and we're doomed. So this is like the doomsayers, like it's all hopeless, we're all doomed, it's going to end in war, we're all going to tear each other to bits, the water's going to run out, the food's going to run out, the ecosystems are going to collapse, the sun's going to fall out of the sky. And this is the kind of the doom and gloom response. And the other response is the technological optimists, and they say, well, we'll fix it. We'll sort out a solution. And if we need more food, then we'll figure out ways of engineering the plant so we can grow more food. If we need to clean the air, we'll figure out some kind of very clever way to clean the air. If we need to get more water, we'll figure out ways of purifying water. If we run out of certain kinds of resources, we'll figure out how to use rubbish or other kinds of resources that we're not using at the moment, and so on and so forth. So this is like another kind of response to this situation. And I don't want to go on about this too much or to debate the merits of these points of views, but just to notice that in either case, whichever of those two is right, and quite possibly both of them are right sometimes and wrong sometimes, but in both of those cases we're leading towards an unprecedented and unpredictable future. If the doomsayers are right, then we're going to be, the international system is going to collapse. The hunger will become so desperate that there'll be massive refugee populations. The low-lying lands like Bangladesh and other places will become flooded because of global warming. And there'll be millions, if not tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of people displaced and refugees all around the world, and cause tremendous strain on resources, and the very fabric of civilization will just collapse. And we'll have a global war or a nuclear war or something. Humanity won't be able to survive, or will survive only in a very primitive way. So that's one kind of option. The other option, if the technological optimists are right, then we're going to fix all these problems, but in fixing them, we're going to change the world unrecognizably. And, you know, what are we going to do? This was satirized very well years ago by the writer Kurt Vonnegut, and he was writing in the 1970s, and he was depicting a world in the future where America had become very primitive and backwards, and the Chinese had got so technologically advanced and so sophisticated that they had so many of them, so many billions and billions of Chinese, that they'd shrunk themselves to be able to use less resources. So originally they shrunk themselves to about the size of a thumb, but then they were still using too many resources because there were so many billions and trillions of them, so they shrunk themselves to about the size of a grain of dust. So you had to be careful when you're sneezing, you'd kind of sneeze out whole populations of millions of Chinese. So it was a very beautiful kind of satire of these kinds of American fears of what can happen in the world. And so this course is a satire, but we don't know what will happen and to what extent we will become integrated with technology. We'll have chips in our brains and all of these kinds of things. These are not science fiction kind of fantasies anymore. These are technologies which people are actually working on and which have already been implemented and tested to some degree. And so the world that we live in will become more and more strange, more and more weird, and will continue to accelerate faster and faster. The pace of change, the scope of technologies will become greater and greater, and the places that will take us to will become more and more unprecedented, more and more unpredictable, more and more varied. And so we somehow, as human beings interested in a spiritual path, we have to steer ourselves among these possible futures. Whatever the future is going to be, it's not going to be boring. It's not going to be the same as the past. And so we're in a very interesting situation, being people who are interested in the teachings of the Buddha as a spiritual guide. And he enunciated a path to liberation 2,500 years ago. Now, if we look at how that path to liberation is described, the essential descriptions, the essential meaning of what he was saying, goes straight to things that appear to be quite universal or quite fundamental to our state as being humans. And, of course, one obvious example of that in the sutta we just chanted, in the Dhammadayada Sutta, for example, the Noble Eightfold Path, and right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. And each one of these things is human. Each one of these things is part of who we are as people living here. You know, right views is like our ideas and concepts we have about the world. We all recognize that we have these things. We have concepts, and that these are subject to scrutiny. These are not necessarily sort of given and hardwired into our brain. These are some things which are always changing, so we can scrutinize, examine them. We can abandon those ones which are defective and hopefully develop better models. So like a right view is like developing a better model, more realistic model of the world in a conceptual framework. And right intention is like what's the direction of our mind? How are we leading it? What kind of motivation do we have for our actions? And so again, we recognize that this is a human quality. It's not like an Indian quality. It's not something which was just characteristic of the people in the time and place of the Buddha, but it seems to be characteristic of all humans. So the same with right speech. Again, all humans, as far as we know, have a form of speech. They want to communicate, even those people who may be born with a speech disability. Maybe they can't actually communicate verbally, but still they want to communicate, and they'll find with a great deal of effort some way of communicating through using sign language or these days through a computer or something like that to be able to communicate. And that even though it takes great effort. So again, it seems to be something that's intrinsic to being human, is this kind of right speech, being able to communicate skillfully and well and in a meaningful way. Right action, of course, you know, we do things, we move our bodies, and this way of moving our body has an ethical content in the sense that it can cause either harm or benefit to others. And so we need to be aware of that. We need to be mindful of that. We need to be able to discern what are those actions we can do that are beneficial, what are those actions that we can do that are harmful, and to avoid those ones that are harmful and do those ones that are beneficial. It's a practice of right action. Right livelihood, again, we have as humans certain physical needs. We need food, we need shelter, we need medicines when we're sick, and so on. And this is not bound down to any one society or culture or time or place. But it's part of who we are as human, is right livelihood. So we need to somehow get some material resources that will enable us to supply those needs. How do we do that? How do we go about actually getting hold of those material resources that will give us what we need? And of course, this is something all people have to do, whether you're a Kalahari bushman who's just, you know, wandering through the desert and maybe hunting animals or digging up roots or something like that, or whether you're a sort of a businessman who's jetting from here and there and speculating on the whatever they have, the money markets or whatever. And in every way you have to have some kind of livelihood, and that has some ethical content, and we're very familiar with that. We've heard of Enron and all of these kinds of scandals and corruption and so on, and we know that many people don't make their livelihood in an honest way, in an ethical way. It's a very important dimension of our lives, of who we are and how we choose to live our lives. And of course, the right effort, again, as humans, not as necessarily Indians or even as Buddhists or anything like that, but as humans, we must make an effort, we must try. And it's not good enough just to have good intentions, but we have to really put that effort and be able to work to overcome things. It was quite interesting. I was watching the guys working today and just noticing, because they're a very good team of workers doing the building, and noticing how they're just kind of going along. You know, three or four guys working and kind of all doing something different, but all kind of understanding what the job is that they're doing, and able to communicate about that, and seeing how that they were constantly encountering problems. You know, somebody had maybe measured something wrongly and something was out, and then there would be this process, okay, this is out, how do we fix it? It was the next immediate next thought. There wasn't a thought of, oh, okay, you're stupid because you got it wrong. But we immediately thought, well, this is out. How do you fix it? You need to adjust something at the other end or put in an extra part, or how do you do it? And then two or three solutions proposed, and eventually it becomes obvious which one's the right one, and then they go on. And then there's another problem, and there's this continual process of actually having to put forth effort to overcome problem after problem after problem. And of course, that's what doing stuff involves. Doing stuff is always nothing other than a series of problems which you have to learn to surmount. And this is your right effort, is that just have that persistence in just keep on going and just surmount the problems one by one as they occur. And that's all that being able to do a job means. It just means that you keep on solving the problems as they come up. That's all. And so this is the right effort, right mindfulness, again, is something that we need as humans, the ability to actually collect ourselves and focus on what we're doing, not something which is only relevant to Indians or only relevant to Asians or only relevant to men or to women or to anything like that. But everybody needs this. It's a skill which we learn, and you know, you can see babies gradually learning these skills to be able to walk, to be able to focus their eyes, to be able to develop those basic motor skills, know what they're doing. This is a kind of very fundamental development of mindfulness. And also right samadhi, to be able to unify one's mind. And this is something which is, in an elementary sense, again, is very necessary for what we're doing, to be able to focus on one thing and keep doing that thing until it's done, and something which is developed to a very high degree through the practice of meditation, until we can find unification, a true unification of mind, where we go beyond those ordinary states of mind. So all of these factors in the Eightfold Path are entirely, it seems to me, entirely context-free and like cultural-free. I mean, I don't know if you can say totally, but pretty much so. And of course, maybe the exact way it's expressed, it sort of owes something to the culture and so on and so forth. So that's fair enough. But when we look at what it's talking about, it seems to address something which is human, something which is very meaningful to all people. And so when we inherit these teachings, we inherit these timeless teachings, these teachings which are universal to the human condition, then what do we do with them? It's important to notice that when we talk about their universal teachings, then as a philosophical point, that this is different from believing in absolute good and evil, which is a common position in many religions, that they believe that good and evil are somehow hardwired into the universe, so that there's a kind of an absolute or an objective measure of what's good and what's evil. And Buddhism doesn't think about things in that way. For Buddhism, what's good leads to happiness, what's bad leads to unhappiness. And so when we say something's universal, we say because when we apply that principle, as far as we know, universally among human societies, then these things will lead to happiness. The good things will lead to happiness, the bad things will lead to unhappiness. So it's like, if you like, universal relative to the human condition. It's not like sort of some cosmic objective law which is sitting out there like the kind of the law of gravity is supposed to do, but it's just relative to our context, our condition as human beings. So we take these timeless truths and we want to try to apply them in this world. You know, we're taking, for example, monastic rules which were formulated at a time when barely writing was available, just barely. Its writing was so tenuous in those days that it's mentioned not in the Bhikkhu Vinaya, but it is in the Bhikkhuni Vinaya. And it seems that because the Bhikkhuni Vinaya was generally settled or finalized later than the Bhikkhu Vinaya, that in that intervening period, that writing had become more popular. So even in that very period while the texts were being settled, perhaps writing had become more widespread and more popular and was seen as being important enough to address within the Bhikkhuni Vinaya. But by that time, the Bhikkhu Vinaya had already become static, and so it wasn't included there. And so for the Buddha and the Buddha's period, writing itself was just barely there, barely existent, and played a small role. And now we live in a world dominated by technology and computers and all of these kinds of things. So we have to learn to interpret things. We can't take everything literally. And I think this is one of the problems with taking a very literal approach to Vinaya and insisting on the letter of the Vinaya, is that in such different contexts, it easily allows us to escape from the spirit of the Vinaya. We can insist on the letter of the rule. But there's so many cases where it's easy to get around the letter of the rule. And in Burma, they have a saying, if you know the Vinaya, you can kill a chicken. If you know the Vinaya, you can kill a chicken. Because they know very well that if someone who studies the Vinaya enough, just like any good lawyer, they can get you out of anything. Yeah? And so if you want to kill a chicken, you kill a chicken. Hire a Vinaya lawyer and you get yourself out of it. You know, it's not a problem. So this is that difference between the letter and the spirit of the law. So this is something we need to be constantly interrogating. We need to be constantly examining. What is that inheritance which we receive from the Buddha? And how do we use that in this current day and age? We have so many things here which we have got as a result of the fact that we have, in some sense, embodied or taken on board this Buddhist tradition. You know, we've taken on ordination and we've supported ordained Sangha and so on. And it's in the understanding that that's the case. This is why we have this monastery here. The monastery was very, with incredible generosity, offered for this purpose. The condition, the monastery wasn't kind of offered with a kind of vague intention that anybody who wants to do good stuff can come here and stay here and practice. It was offered for Buddhist monks, nuns, lay people to come here and meditate, study the Dhamma and try to realize Nibbana. This was the purpose that Sister Nirodha's great gift was given. And so, in this sense, we are the heirs of the Buddha in a material sense. We are offered roads, we are offered alms food by people because they wish to support this tradition. And, you know, imagine what would happen if we weren't in that situation. What would happen if we weren't properly ordained Sangha, if we hadn't had that ordination, we didn't wear the robes and so on. Maybe we'd be just as good people inside. Maybe we'd be better people inside. Maybe we'd be more wholesome, more pure, more happy, more free. And yet, people wouldn't be coming and giving us these things. You know, we would be like so many other very sincere and dedicated lay practitioners or lay people on a spiritual search who are trying their hardest in a very sincere way to seek for truth, to seek for freedom and so on. But nobody ever thinks of them. Nobody thinks to offer them meals. Nobody thinks to provide them a quiet place to meditate so that they can do their practice and so on. The reason why people do these things for us is because in some sense we represent externally the image of someone who's following the way of the Buddha. And of course that's easy to fake. It's very easy to put on a robe and to shave your head and to look like you're a monk or a nun, and to sort of pretend that you're doing the right thing, whereas in fact you're not. And so of course this is not at all uncommon that we find people, men and women, will put on robes, of course far more men than women, because the monks get more requisites than the nuns do. So it's much more common to see, you know, men will put on robes, shave their head and pretend to be monks and get lots of stuff, get lots of offerings, get lots of money. And you can make quite a lot of cash doing that. And not only do fakes do that, like bogus monks, but also real monks do it as well, you know, and people who have had a proper ordination and are technically bhikkhus, but they will, you know, quite shamelessly engage in things just for getting money and for living a luxurious lifestyle and these kinds of things. And maybe very often they might be setting up funds so that they can later on disrobe and go and live a life of luxury and so on and so forth. This also is quite common. And so apart from this kind of overt corruption, then there's a more kind of subtle defilements and corruption that in a community like this, which has people who are basically sincere and honest, but within each one of us, then still these kinds of corruptions are found. They're still evident. There are still times when we covet beautiful things. We were looking in the stores the other day and there was this quite snazzy little watch thing that you kind of clip onto your belt. Kind of thing that monks like. And I've never used a watch. I remember I had a watch when I was a kid, and one time we were going swimming in the river, the Swan River, and we were jumping off a cliff in the Swan River. And then by the time I jumped off and swam around and climbed back up again, I'd taken off my watch and it had disappeared from under the rock where I'd kept it. So I think that was probably the last time that I'd ever had a watch. I was about 14 or 15 or something. And so I saw this thing, I thought, oh, it looks quite nice, I'll try wearing that for a while. And then I wore it for a day, and it was so kind of clunky and awkward. I thought, what the hell am I wearing this stupid thing for? I took it off and put it back in the stores again. So that was the end of that. But this is something which is always coming up. Like, what do you have? You know, what things do you have? What are you living the holy life for? And, you know, it is quite amazing that, you know, when you've given up so much, but of course the kind of the defilements tend to settle on things which maybe you'd never even thought of before. And so, you know, you tend to get focused and redirected into stuff, you know, like sort of intense, you know, interest in food, you know, what kind of food are you going to have in the mealtime? And it's very normal that when one first comes to the monastery that food becomes a very big issue. Ajahn Chah said that his first 2 years of meditation were just food. nothing else, just food. And I can't say my meditation was just food for the first 2 years, but it wasn't far off it. I remember when I was doing the cooking in Kanchanaburi and in Dardam, and I was at Anagarika, and I'd come to the monastery for a few weeks, and the monks were all going to go off on retreat, and there was one nun there, one laywoman also coming on the retreat, to go on retreat in the middle of the very, very deep jungle, right on the Burmese border. And so we went off, we had to walk into the retreat. I could tell you lots of stories about this retreat. And by the third day of walking to get in there, my feet were so hacked up and full of cracks, I could hardly walk. And but still, Ajahn Pasano, in his great, fathomless compassion, insisted that I go on alms round together with the monks with no shoes on, into this muddy little Burmese hill tribe village to get alms, and then walk for the rest of the day to get into the place. And then I used to cook. So I used to get up in the morning before dawn, I guess, I can't remember, 4 o'clock or something, and have to walk down this muddy little track for about an hour, and then crossing over these kind of bamboo bridges and, you know, so many snakes, you just ignore them after a while. And, you know, vicious, carnivorous, biting ants and horse flies and leeches and, you know, tigers in the forest and elephants and bears and nameless things that screech like black riders in the night. I never heard any of them, but a friend of mine heard one. I'm sure they're there. And I didn't actually see any elephants either, I have to admit, or any tigers, all right, but some people have seen them in that area. And we walk down to the village, and there you are in the village with all of the with a few workers there, like Burmese workers. So you've spent, you know, all these ages trying to learn a few words of Thai so you can communicate, and you realize now they're talking in Burmese. And then you went back to Nanachat and you realize they're talking in Lao. You know, what am I trying to learn Thai for? No one seems to speak Thai in Thailand. It's actually only radio announcers and school teachers who actually speak Thai in Thailand. Everyone else speaks dialects. And there you'd have like a knife and a chopping board and a variable supply of veggies and things like that and a coal little fire burner thing with a wok, and then you'd prepare food for 20 or 30 people every day, and they came down at like 8 o'clock or 8:30 in the morning. And one time when I was down there and it was still dark when I was there, and I was trying to walk around, I'd been up all night for the all-night meditation, because you're wearing white, because like as an Anagarika, you're wearing white clothes, white robes. And I fell down into the rubbish pit, which is where they threw all the scraps. It was like 8 feet deep or something like that. It was over my head, but filled with scraps of old food and stuff like that. And I just fell into it in the dark because I couldn't see where I was going. And then just kind of crawling out of there and, oh, God. Oh, just trying to wash up and that and go back and cleaning up, cooking up the food and things. Luckily, I like cooking, so I didn't. I'm making this sound very dreadful, but actually, I actually had a lot of good fun doing it. And doing it with Tommy. That's right. Tommy was deaf and dumb, and he was the main cooking assistant, which was sometimes interesting, trying to work out actually what we were supposed to be cooking. And so then after getting up in the morning and doing all this kind of stuff and then walk back up to my kuti, did I mention the cerebral malaria? Perhaps I... The previous cook had died, right, which is why we had to do this. The previous cook had died of cerebral malaria. And I hope I'm not making this sound overly dramatic or anything like that, but then you walk back to my kuti and then just think about food for the rest of the day until about 6 o'clock or something like that. You know, what are you going to cook for tomorrow? What have you cooked, or what's good and what's not good, blah, blah, blah. And about 6 o'clock in the evening, I managed to sort of have about an hour or so free of thinking about food for a while. It was a bit of kind of relief. And so that was that retreat. And so kind of funny, you know, then after a while, these things just don't matter so much anymore. I mean, when I was a young monk, I did various kinds of practices to sort of overcome greed and attachment to food, you know, eating pindabhata food and just having one meal a day very strictly and these kinds of things. And, you know, after a while, it's just not such a big deal anymore these days. I'm not really that fussed about it. You just, food comes along, you just eat it, and that's all there is to it. I don't really think about it. So there's this different relation, you know, we always kind of inherit these things. I mean, one of the things I've always noticed as a monk is that, you know, you always get really good food. I mean, certainly I have, no matter where I am, that almost always in almost every place, I ended up, you know, eating amazing food. And what's the cause for this? What's the condition? Of course, the condition is letting go and not trying to get things, not wanting things. And these things come, and people make much more of an effort to feed you than you would if you were eating by yourself or just feeding yourself. And it becomes something special, a very special offering that people do. And so we inherit these, you know, we're sort of practicing giving up, but we inherit these incredible, delicious, luxurious lunches and dinners that we, well, not dinners, but meals that we have every day. And, you know, we sometimes forget that actually people don't eat this stuff. You know, people in the world, a lot of them don't have any proper food. Or if they do have food, they just have something that's very, very simple. And even people who can afford good food very often don't actually eat good food. They very often just eat a bit of junk food or something like that, or a bit of sandwich or something. And so we're so incredibly privileged to receive these things, and we need to make it a constant reflection that, you know, the ability we have to have these things, to benefit from such an incredibly lovely monastery. This is the most beautiful and suitable place for practice of a monastery I've ever seen anywhere in the world. And I've seen many beautiful places. I've never seen anywhere as good as Santi Monastery. And physically, it's stunningly beautiful and incredibly suitable for practice. And we're able to make these beautiful buildings here and have these places to stay in. We're all inheriting these things from the Buddha, from the Buddha's efforts, from the Buddha's enlightenment, from the Buddha's reputation. And this is what gives people the faith to be able to support the Sangha. And so we have to learn, how do we live as Sangha in a place like this, in a time like this, in an age like this? How do we cope with such complexity? How do we cope with such material riches? How do we cope with a world which is ever expanding, ever diversifying, ever accelerating? How do we actually deal with these things within this framework of the Vinaya which we've inherited? How do we take these very beautiful, very simple principles that the Buddha taught and then apply them in this very complex situation in which we find ourselves? So this is my little talk for you this evening on being an inheritor of material things from the Buddha, the subject of the Dhammadayada Sutta, which we've just been chanting. So I offer this to you for your reflection and contemplation and amusement. And anyone has any comments or questions, you're most welcome. Okay, very good. Let's finish by paying respects.
Svakato bhagavata dhammo dhammam asam. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangha.